The first half of this story is adorable, isn't it? Here we meet young Samuel, who models for us a life that is faithful, open to God's leading, attentive to God's voice. Though he's been removed from his parents and lives with an old man in a dark, creepy building, there's no suggestion of trauma or feelings of abandonment. We imagine him happily living his little life, glad to be of service, cared for and mentored by the old priest, Eli. He even had a little priest costume, a linen ephod. Every year, we're told, when his mother Hannah would visit him at the Shiloh temple, she would bring to him a slightly larger version of the costume that she had knit for him that year. At first glance, the scene might make us wistful, wishing that we ourselves had lives as simple and pious as the young boy Samuel, enjoying easy access to God and God's guidance for our lives. For little Samuel, the middle of the night was a time for lucid dreaming. During this particular night, God tiptoes into little Samuel's bedroom and calls his name. And then a cute little game ensues, with Samuel thinking that it's the priest Eli calling to him. Now, it would be nice, I suppose, to live in a world where your sleep is gently interrupted by the living God who calls your name and then gives you clear direction about what in the world you're supposed to be doing with your life. Speaking personally, though, the stuff that wakes me up in the middle of the night seems less uplifting. Heartburn, for example, insomnia, a phone call with bad news, leg cramps, anxiety about the credit card bill, stumbling to the bathroom, then catching your toe on the dresser on your way back, your kids appearing bedside to let you know that they've just thrown up. Rarely do I awake feeling like the night has been filled with God's clear, crisp, commanding voice. What about you? The problem with Bible stories that appear precious is that we tend not to believe them. If the stories seem like they come to us from some faraway Bible world where everyone is easily in tune with God, then we lose any confidence that they'll ever speak a lively word into the muck and mess and confusion and pain of our own lives. And even when we strain as best we can to listen for God's Spirit to speak to us, in all the ways that Elisha mentioned, even when we do that, we rarely hear anything clear or certain. We don't sleep like little Samuel in the sacred dark of the Holy of Holies. Our lives are this massive journey through the ordinary. And we have to face the future with not much more than a collection of messy stories, the testimony of some friends, a little gossip, and a lot of guesswork. Now, if we're paying attention, there are clues that warn us against reading the story in a nostalgic way, as if this is some sort of mythic Eden, when listening for God's guidance was straightforward and clear-cut for everyone. Verse 1, did you catch it? The word of the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were not widespread. So this isn't a story about the good old days. This is a story for people like you and like me. People who have to move forward with only wisps and whispers of God's presence. We get very few clear directives etched in stone. Fortunately, our reading today includes not just that cute first half about little Samuel padding around in his pajamas. It also includes that next part, which feels very different. When Samuel finally says, "Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening," what he hears from God is far from precious. The message from God is judgment that is demanding and decisive. Yes, God will be faithful to Israel, but no longer in the same old ways. The familiar traditions won't work. The comfortable sacred space at the Shiloh temple is part of the past, and all the religious professionals like Eli and his family will no longer play a role. What God speaks to Samuel is news of a decisive new direction for Israel's life that will disrupt most of what they've come to know and love. Now, I think we can benefit from listening to this story as kind of a rigorous reflection by Israel on change. Israel's life during this period is in transition away from sort of a group of loosely federated tribes described in the book of Judges. It's a transition from that towards a life when they're becoming a real nation state with a king and a standing army. So we can listen in as Israel wrestles with how to hear God's voice when life is filled with the noise of the future fracturing away from the familiar past. So the question here in the story is whether we are ready to receive God's gracious care and provision for our lives, but in new forms, in new containers. Can we really trust that God will be with us during periods of change and transition when the familiar frameworks fail us? Now, at first reading, we excuse young Samuel for running to old Eli three different times in the middle of the night. We interpret his mistake as a sign of young Samuel's innocence. But on a second reading, now that we're aware of God's decisive judgment on Eli and all the religious authorities that Eli represents, now we can see that Samuel's experience going back and back to Eli expresses the tension that all of us face. Listening for God's voice and trusting in God during periods of change may require us to listen to new voices. Sometimes God needs to lead us into new places where the familiar faces and the old traditions can't go with us. In the book Creativity, Inc., those of you on session we're reading this book together. In the book Creativity, Inc., Ed Catmull tells his own life story, and he describes the founding of Pixar Studios. When Catmull was young, he loved storytelling on the one hand, and he loved computers. But he was never sure how these two things were supposed to go together. Art and technology seemed like two totally different things, like oil and water. Eventually, these two different parts of his life merged into an audacious goal. Catmull's dream was to produce the first ever feature-length, computer-generated animated movie. That's what he wanted to do with his life. When he tried to share this vision with some of the movie studios he was working with, like, for instance, Disney Studios, the talented artists who were animating movies by hand weren't too excited about this computer nerd. So in the first several jobs that Catmull had, he would develop little bits of software that would make animating movies much more efficient. And then the artists that had been hand-drawing all these scenes for years said, "Oh, that's nifty, but no thanks, we're fine." In their minds, there was no way you could tell captivating, compelling stories by writing computer code. It just wouldn't work. So Catmull then founded his own company devoted to computer animation called Pixar Studios. And that studio was later purchased and led then by Steve Jobs. It was later acquired by Walt Disney Studios. And if you have kids or grandkids, or you just like animated movies, you've seen a whole bunch of these blockbuster computer animated films by Pixar. See if you've heard of a few of these. They've made a little money in the past 20 years. Toy Story, A Bug's Life, Finding Nemo, Cars, The Incredibles, Ratatouille, WALL-E, Monsters, Inc., Up, Coco, and there's some other ones that I've missed, but those are some of the big ones. Now, there's nothing wrong, of course, with animating films by hand, by drawing them out with your hand, right? It's just that the world has shifted in important ways, and in this new environment, the old traditions won't work. Now, the good news for us today is that God's ongoing care and devotion to us is not tied to any particular historical period or political pattern of life. God's love for us isn't woven together with any particular cultural moment or even any established frameworks for worship and church life and spiritual life. When we confess, this is Hebrews 13:8, when we confess that Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever, it's not a confession that faith is repetitious and boring. It's a confession that energizes us for an always shifting, always changing future in which the living Christ will come to us and equip us for our ministry and our work and our fellowship, no matter what comes our way. Now, in many ways, we just don't have any choice, right? We have to adapt. We have to reconfigure our lives. We might complain about it, but we eventually move on. Our own development through childhood and adolescence and on into the various stages of adulthood require an almost continual repositioning of who we are and how we live and how we understand our lives. Not many of us are devoted to the landlines in our homes anymore. We use cell phones. Not many of us are penning handwritten letters. Ann Emerson and a few others, the exceptions. Newspapers aren't really papers anymore. When I owe my friends for dinner, they don't want a check. They want me to PayPal them or Venmo them. We have access to boundless information online. We have all kinds of ways to stay in touch digitally with far wider groups of friends than was ever possible before. So lots of change, right? And not all these changes are clearly positive. They don't all make our lives easier or better. When I listen to young people looking ahead at the shifts in the job market and the rise of the gig economy, a little work here, a little work there, they wonder whether college is worth it, whether going into debt for college is worth it. The way the job market has clustered lots of the high-paying jobs in urban areas has changed the delicate dynamics in our country between urban and rural places. And one of the upshots of all this other change in our country is the emergence of a lack of trust between us, between neighbors, a breakdown of civil conversations and respect. A feeling that when we have different perspectives, we're somehow at war with each other. This is a change too, and it's hard to figure out how to move forward. During periods of rapid change, when what's comfortable for us gives way to something that's less familiar, it's easy for us to become overwhelmed with all the different powerful forces reshaping our worlds. And when we're overwhelmed with all the change, it's hard for us to imagine God's presence and love as serious factors that make our lives what they are and that shape the world in which God delights. Another way to put it would just be to say, when it's noisy, it's hard for us to hear God speaking to us. Those of us who love the Presbyterian Church and call it home, we're not immune to change, of course. The average Presbyterian is a 63-year-old white woman. I've told you this before, right? Now, putting the matter that way sounds more blunt than it needs to. All of us know that our congregation, no congregation can function without 63-year-old white women. So, by the way, if this is you, 63-year-old white woman, let me just say as clearly as I possibly can, we're delighted you're here. We need some more of you. Please invite your friends, okay? So that's not the problem. The challenge for all of us is that the demographics of many communities are changing, including our own. In general, we're becoming more multicolored, less reliant on traditional patterns of marriage or family life and what that should look like. And so God is calling all of us to reimagine what the good news of Jesus Christ looks like for a changing world. What do fellowship and worship and care and justice, what does all that look like when there are new people with different experiences and different stories gathering around the table of God's gracious feast? If you take a wider look at some of the social and spiritual trends, you see changes as well. The Pew polling shows us that a full 20% of Americans, that's 46 million Americans, have no religious affiliation whatsoever. That doesn't mean that they're atheists. It doesn't mean that they don't trust in God or pray to God or believe in God. It just means that they aren't connected to a network or organization for their support, for their spiritual life. The millennial generation, those born after 1986, those young people are finding meaning and purpose and friendship and accountability and spirituality in a whole wide variety of different ways, but for the most part, institutional, traditional-looking churches aren't their primary way of relating to or connecting to God. So like Samuel, we will need to find ways to wean ourselves from the old comforting authorities and from those familiar patterns so that we can trust in God as God leads us into a future whose contours we can't even yet see. And we will be okay. Diana Butler Bass argues in her book Grounded that the primary story of our time is not kind of the story I've just told you. It's not really the decline of church affiliation or the irrelevance of religious institutions like this wonderful building in which we sit. That's not really the story. Rather, Butler Bass argues that the primary story is a massive shift for most people into a new and different kind of spiritual life, a different sensibility, a different way of imagining the sacred and how God is woven into our lives. So Butler Bass says you can think of it like this. In the old way, faith used to be vertical, right? Faith was up and down. That is, God lives in heaven, and churches are these sacred spaces where we can come to connect to this distant vertical God. That's what churches used to be. Now, that vision of life, she argues, is losing its grip for lots of people, but certainly for young people. Now faith is becoming more horizontal. That is, the earth is sacred, daily life is sacred, ordinary things are sacred. I can find God in a very personal way in all of my daily comings and goings. I no longer need the church as a place that connects me vertically to an absent God. If I need church at all in this new day, I need church to be a place that honors and acknowledges that everything is sacred, that everything about my life is sacred, that the whole of my experience is sacred, that my daily life as I leave here is the place where the holy dwells. That's what we need from church. So if Butler Bass is right about this shift to a very personal God who dwells in the earthly and ordinary circuits of our lives, then congregations like ours do have a new role to play. We can be a community where people come together to hear that their lives are already full of sacredness and holiness and love. People can gather to hear an affirming word about the importance of their ordinary lives, and then we can all be sent back out into our lives with the good news that the earthy God is present in all of our ordinary daily tasks and challenges through the week. So friends, today's reading from Samuel doesn't ask us to turn our attention back to some simple time. The story invites us instead to turn ourselves forward, to face the future as God's people with full trust that God will lead us forward. It invites us to live faithfully into all the changes and transitions of our lives and to trust the good news that God's love for us in Jesus Christ will be our wisdom as we move into that different future. This is a good word. I hope it's an encouraging word for people like us living in transitional times. Sometimes we feel unmoored or lost or confused, even whipsawed by the pace of change and the shifting of long-standing patterns. But there is good news of the abiding presence of the living Christ, even when the normal rhythms of our lives have become unstuck. So here we are, Lord. Free us from anything that's unfaithful or stale or closed down, and send us out into the future as friends of Jesus Christ.